Accession number 27329, Reel 2.
But the whole idea of the, again, of the structure of the day from 6:30 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, again, was all part, and this big word discipline keeps coming up all the time. It was to get yourselves into a routine of organising yourself. You know, you had to be at certain places at certain times, a very structured life, whether you liked it or not, because we're all under military discipline, and if you failed to turn up at a certain time, then you could be charged. And there was a charging system where I don't mean charged money wise, I mean charged under discipline, under the rules, and you'd have to go up in front of the company commander at 10 o'clock in the morning. They were called orders, company commander's orders, and that used to be quite regular. I touch wood. Well, not touch wood, I mean, it wasn't luck, it was just behaving myself. I was never charged in my first year. Then when I became a Lance Corporal, of course, you had the responsibility then, you could, in fact, charge the lads in your under your control if they failed to turn up for a parade, or if they were dirty, or if they failed inspection. You'd have to march them up. And that was another thing we learnt, you see, of how to do that, how to make out the necessary charge sheets and the forms. Bring him up in front of the sergeant major, and he would look at it and see whether it was a waste of time or not, if he thought it was going to be a form of punishment, because he could dish out his own punishment without going up in front of the officer, the company commander. And that used to happen quite a bit. He'd say, well, we're not going to charge this lad, I'll give him some extra duties, right, and he would do that. But if it was something bordering on the serious, then it would go up in front of the officer. They'd be charged, they'd be punished, and the punishment could range from anything from being gated, not allowed out of camp, being put in jail, of course, for the really serious ones, in our own guardroom prison, which they had about 8 or 9 cells where they could go in, or CB, confined to barracks, or commonly called jankers, which was probably one of the hardest things to do, because if an individual, an apprentice tradesman, got, say, 7 days CB or 7 days jankers, that meant, apart from all the normal routines that he had as a tradesman, his own time was put up to the guard room, given out fatigues. So it was a real serious punishment there, and it did put a lot of people off. Mind you, some of the lads, you know, who were only there to learn a trade, they couldn't care less about the regimental side. On reflection now at old boys' reunions, they probably did most of their time doing chankers, as they called it, and doing extra fatigues. But, you know, they managed, and they learned from it that way. So yeah, that's... So the structure of the life, all the way through the day, was very much on a program. You knew what your program was each term, where you were going, what classrooms you were in, where you should be at what time. Oh, and of course we'd have the sports fitted into all that as well, on either Wednesday afternoon or Saturday afternoon, because there was always something on a Saturday morning, either a regimental parade or extra work in the workshops or whatever. So there was always that. But then there would be sport on Saturday afternoons, and sport on Sunday afternoons as well, after church was finished, and after, because that was all compulsory as well, whether you liked it or not. You know, everybody went to church on a Sunday morning. Again, it's all part of learning, because the actual Christian side fitted in, religious training fitted in. We had a padre in the school, dedicated to the school. And he would take padre's hours throughout the week and run the services on Sunday. Most of us were Church of England, but there was a Roman Catholic priest as well. Methodists and Baptists used to join us in the Church of England. There were one or two agnostics in those days. Not a lot. I mean, most of them thought, oh, well, you know, I've never gone to church before I joined here, so if I put C of E down, I'll get away with it. I'll do what I have to do, and that's it. But one or two were in our intake were agnostics, and they refused to go in, and they would have to do fatigues while we were in there doing church services. And in our intake, I think we had one Jewish lad who did his own thing. Not easy for him, but he sort of did his own thing. So yeah, so there we are. So yeah, good routine. I'm still doing it now. I'm still getting up at 6:30 or 6 o'clock. It's sort of in the brain, much to the family's annoyance. But anyway, yeah, there we are.
So when did you pass out of boys' school?
Yeah, that was in the July of 1954. I had the privilege, being the boy senior boy sergeant major, of actually taking the passing out parade with all the families there. And the inspecting officer was a member of parliament. He was a defence minister, Anthony Head. We all thought we were let down a bit because we wanted a general to take it, you know. But no, this guy turned up and very tall and elegant with his morning suit on and his top hat and whatever. So he took the parade. And that was a great day. And that really was your last day. Everything was all packed up. The parade took place on the square, down to the camp hall for prize giving, whatever prizes were there, being given out, not just for the people passing out, but for the whole school for that term. And then off you went, you handed in your last bit of uniform that belonged to the school. Off you went with your parents or whoever had come to collect you, and that was it. On leave until you were actually posted to your first regular army unit, and that depended on what trade you were, where you actually went, because they did they tried to get you to go to a first unit where you would carry on continuation training and to get your other trade qualifications on, fairly obviously, you know, because you're only we were all anywhere between the ages of 18 or 19 and a half when we passed out. So we still had a lot, although we'd done all this training and got our qualifications, we're still on the bottom of a big long learning curve. So yeah, so that was in July 54.
So where were you posted to after that?
Well, with us, with the telemechs, the telecommunications mechanics, the principle they had adopted over a few years was to split us into three groups for the first posting. And we all went to what were called in those days base workshops in England, where military and civilian workshops, where they did major overhauls of radio equipment right down to the rock bottom, and they were all built up again. And it was a good place to go to do continuation training. And you could either go to Greenford in Middlesex, Donington up in Shropshire, or Newark up in Nottinghamshire. And I was fortunate enough to be posted to Greenford in Middlesex, which was like going from hell to heaven, in a way. The actual camp itself at Greenford, the workshops was called 36 Base Workshops at Greenford. The camp itself was a very basic, crude Nissen hut type accommodation. It was there long before the war. It was used during the war by soldiers, and we went to it. But the workshops itself were brilliant. You were really looked after there. I don't know, the total strength of the whole workshops was no more than about 75, 80 people, 80 soldiers, maybe less. Nearly all ex-apprentices, a fair amount of national servicemen, and there we progressed learning our trade as well. The sheer freedom of going to a regular unit, all right, we had no rank, all of us, we were all craftsmen, but the sheer fact that when it came to you'd done your work at the end of the day in the workshops, you were back in the cookhouse for tea, and if you were not on guard duty, you were free. You could do what you like. The thing about Greenford was, and still is, it's on the end of the tube line in London. So, you know, once you've done all you had to do after work, if you wanted to, and with the money that you were getting in those days, I can't remember. You mentioned before, Hazel, about what our salary was, and I can't remember what it was in the regular army. In today's terms, it was quite poor, but to us, it was brilliant. You know, it was all pocket money. We had no attachments, most of us. And you could spend it on what you like, you know. It was really, really good. And at Greenford, you were posted there on a, I think it was a 2-year tour. And during that 2 years, the idea was, it was, as I said, continuation training, working on the bench in the workshop, learning from either civilians or a sergeant or an artificer running the section you were in. Just learning all the techniques, learning how the radios worked, learning how to test them, etc., etc. And then, in those days, we could actually do the trade tests to progress from third class to second class to first class. You could do those trade tests within that workshops. They had proper training sections that had mostly civilian people running them. But they all knew what it was all about. They knew what standards you had to achieve. And, of course, you got paid then by your trade qualifications. So everybody was dead keen to progress up to second class and then up to first class. You didn't have to have any rank. You could be a first-class craftsman in those days, which was brilliant because there were some wonderful people there, not only from our intake boys' school, but also National Service guys. Some of them had degrees in electronics, and they were absolutely fantastic on the bench. They weren't interested in doing soldering, you know. They came out and, oh, well, yeah, you tell me what to do, Corporal, and I'll do it, but I'm here to do my 2-year National Service and get on with the job. And for us ex-apprentices, you could, if you weren't interested at that stage of getting any rank or promotion, then fine, you could concentrate on your work, get your Class 1 trade test, get paid for it, but not have any military responsibility. The schemes did change over the years, and nowadays rank comes with your trade qualification, and your money obviously increases as well. But there were very sensible rules in those days. You know, you could be excellent on your equipment, but a useless soldier. But at least you were doing the job and you were learning and you were being paid for being a technician, for doing a good job as a mechanic. Now, I was fortunate in that unit that with my background as a boy sergeant major and going there, I mean, that follows you. Obviously, your records all follow you. And so the OC of the unit, this new intake of boy soldiers, he would have all our documentation. He would know how we did on boy service, and coming into man service, what our discipline was like, what we were good at, what we were bad at, and we were kept, and an eye was kept on them. So after I'd been there about 6 months, I think it was in early 55, about three of us were called forward and given one stripe. Lance Corporal, right, you're going to be in charge of the barrack room, you've got one stripe, off you go. So we did that, and then we got some trade qualifications. I got promoted then to full corporal after the first year. So I was then, coming up 18. I was 18 when I passed out, 18 and a half. So at 19 and a half, I got my two stripes on my arm. And then a couple of the sergeants were posted out. And this would never happen in this day and age. But I was called forward and up to the commanding officer. And they said, we've got a vacancy for a sergeant here, Corporal Morton. We're going to give you an acting unpaid rank of three stripes because we desperately need a sergeant here. They can't post anybody in. So you've got it for the time that you're here because we need you to do the work that the sergeant does. So I was then promoted to sergeant, which was unbelievable, to move from the barrack room into the sergeant's mess. I remember the RSM at the time saying to me, this is the biggest jump you will ever make in all your service. Whatever you do with yourself from now on, Morton, he said, you are coming out of the barrack room, you are going into my sergeant's mess, he said, and I expect you to behave like that. And he said, if I hear you, Sergeant Morton, talking to all these other characters that you've done your 3-year apprenticeship with, if they start calling you by your first name within my earshot, I'll have that third stripe off of you. You can, Corporal, you can go and join them again. Oh, yes, sir. Right, sir. No, you know, no problem, sir. What had happened there during that period, of course, at Greenford, the actual camp itself, where we were accommodated, because it was so poorly in condition, such a poor condition, actually closed down. We still worked in the same workshops, but we all had to move up to Mill Hill to 10 command workshops, which was a much more modern set of barracks. And so we all moved up there, and we were bussed into work every day. When we were actually in Greenford itself, at the camp, we used to march to work every day. Now, I must mention this, because we had to cross this main road from camp. I can see it now, a roundabout, traffic coming in across the road. It was about a mile. We had to march every day. So we'd have our parade in camp. Two boys would be brought out. One had to carry a board in the front, one had to carry a board at the back that said danger, troops marching, and they had to march in front of the squad up to any junctions, or primarily this roundabout, get in the road, put your hand up like a lollipop lady while the troops went round. Now that road was the A40, which is now the part of the I think it's the M40 that comes out of London, and we often reminisce now that it'd be quite interesting to try and go across the motorway with these troops holding up this board. Some of us used to dread being picked out, you know, because it was quite hairy actually up the front at the back. But one or two of the old stalwarts used to volunteer every day. Right, I want to volunteer for the board. I'll do it, Sarge, and off they go holding up the traffic. So that was one of the excitements we had. But that all stopped, of course, and we were bussed into work then from Mill Hill to Greenford. And life was good. I mean, I was a single guy anyway, so I lived in the sergeant's mess up there with all the old stages. And that's, again, where the RSM's words were absolutely right. The sergeant's mess is a club, a very unique club that you join. And you get all the respect for being a senior NCO, but again, that respect, with that privilege, comes a responsibility. And he was quite right about the lads calling you Alan, you know, which they'd done. Well, actually, I did have a nickname called Algie. If anybody calls me Algie now, it's those that knew me on boy service. Where it came from, I don't know. Maybe Alan James, Al J, that way. Or it may be some crack that somebody made, you know, about me. So if any of those, going back to me being a sergeant and all my friends, and all of them were, you know, corporals or craftsmen, it got very difficult. It didn't matter in the workshops, because we were all working together anyway. As long as the OC workshops didn't mind, he didn't hear it too often, you know. They knew that when he was in there, they said, "Oh, Sergeant Morton, can you come over here, please?" But that was good. And life was very good. But of course, in 1956, after we'd been there about 2 years, the Suez Crisis started. And in the run-up to it, when it was decided that the British Army were going to go in and try and take the Suez Canal back again, people were getting posted down to the depot and sent to units that were going to go out to the Middle East. And, of course, Greenford and all other base workshops, they were looking at tradesmen to build up workshops to go out there. And so us guys in Greenford were being picked off slowly all through the early summer of 1956 to be posted back to the depot to go to a unit to go overseas. And it was almost, you know, you were dreading a signal coming in or a telegram coming in to say that you were off. And my turn did come up. I was called down to the adjutant's office, and he said, "Right, Sergeant Morton, there's your posting order, depot. You're going off to Aden. And I haven't got much time. I think you've got to be down there within a week. You've got some leave first and get down there, and then they'll be up on a plane and you'll be off. I said, okay, sir. I said, what about this third stripe of mine, you see? I said, that was only local, wasn't it? And he said, yes, it was, and it is. He said, but I tell you what you do, he said, just chance your luck. He said, go down there with the three stripes on your arm and see what happens. If they take it off you down there, they take it off you. But you'll leave here as a sergeant, you can go down there. Well, actually, that happened. I went down there. I was posted in as a sergeant. The Remy Depot here in Arborfield was a mass with troops going out. And they couldn't care less, really, whether you were a corporal or a sergeant. It got a bit confusing in my case. But they thought, oh, well, we haven't got any time to worry about that now. Sergeant Morton, off you go. So I was put on this draft, as they called it those days, a draft, a group of soldiers. And we were flown out to Aden. In, I think it was about the September of 1956, something like that. And I arrived in Aden. I was a telemech, class one. And we all formed up. We arrived late at night in Aden. We were all put into our accommodation and told to form up on parade the next day. And we told where we were going to be working. So we all formed up on this parade and names were being called out. And some of us were put into one group and some of us were put into another group, and these buses all turned up, and I was in a particular group. And I remember this officer at the front saying, right, the group on my right get on that, those buses, you are staying in Aden. This lot, you are going to get on those buses and go to another part of the airport, and you are going up to Bahrain. Now my geography wasn't very good in the Middle East at that time, and I thought Bahrain was just a little bus ride around the corner. I didn't realise it was all the way up the Persian Gulf, you know. So I was posted up there, up to the Persian Gulf for the to Bahrain for the duration of the Suez Crisis. And all we had there on the in Bahrain was on the airstrip, a little workshops that was looking after. There wasn't a regiment of troops there. There were two companies of infantry soldiers, and so we were looking after the equipment they were there. And I still kept my three stripes. And we stayed there until the Suez fiasco, as it turned out, all finished in the late 56, when everybody had to withdraw, go back home. And all of us that were posted out were slowly being posted again, either back to UK, and all the National Service guys went back to UK. But they looked at all the regular people who were out in the Middle East. These are the people that posted, the Remy people. And I assume they looked and said, well, who's due a tour overseas? No point in bringing them back if they're going to be posted overseas anyway. So I was picked out, Sergeant Morton, to go to Cyprus from Bahrain in 1957. And off I went. Now, Cyprus in those days was like Northern Ireland is or used to be, quite intensive terrorist activity in those days. The old Union with Greece problems that were going on. And the island wasn't split, of course. It was one island, and the Turkish and Greek communities all lived together. So I was posted up there in 1957. Still as with my acting sergeant still on, still hanging on like grim death, dreading that somebody was going to break me down to corporal again, you know.
Were you being paid?
Yeah. By then I was being paid as a sergeant, which was, again, a nice bonus. That happened when I got to Bahrain, actually. They decided that, you've had the rank now for a year, so we'll pay you. It wasn't what we call substantive. I mean, it could have come down at any time. I was too young, really. I mean, I was only, I had my 21st birthday in Bahrain then. So I was too young to become a substantive sergeant. So I went to Cyprus to the district workshops in Nikilia. Excellent posting that was, even though there was trouble on. You know, the duties were pretty hairy and pretty scary. Downtown, you know, going around on armed patrols. There were the odd bombs going off, just like Northern Ireland. So you had to be pretty vigilant with your security. But that was fine, and we managed. And it was there that I thought strongly then about making my next step in my career of becoming an artificer. And for that, you had to go on a selection board. Normally, you would have all gone back to UK to do a selection board there and then come back again. But with the situation as it was in 1957, in the Middle East. There was a selection board in Tripoli that had closed and had moved to Cyprus. So I did my selection board in Cyprus itself, sat the exams that were sent out, the written exams which were sent out from England, did all the command tasks and selection procedure, given little lecturettes which you have to do, and I passed that. So in 1958, I think it was the summer of 1958, I came back to England on my artificer course, which was fine. It must have been 21. Yeah, it was the end of 58. I was just coming up for the 22nd birthday, 23rd birthday. And so then 18 months started then training here in Armourfield in what was then called 3 Training Battalion, where you did 18 months of very intense technical training. We did all the military training first of all of us sergeants. You kept the rank of sergeant all the way through your artificer course. Did all the training, military training then at Borden, passed that, come up here to Armourfield, and then there was a good 15 months really intense technical training. Exams to do regularly, each phase is different equipment to learn, different techniques, all technical, all very technical. And I finished that in, I think it was 1958, no, in 1960. In March 1960, there were 12 of us on our course, Art Tells 28, it was called. And we all passed that with 3 stripes to crown, substantive. You can only be come down again if you've done something really dramatically wrong with a court-martial. Substantive staff sergeants. And that really was the big breakthrough. I was that was in 1960, 25, with 3 stripes and a crown, and that was lovely. That was really good, and that was what really made me think seriously then about staying in above and beyond the 8-year term of service which I'd signed on for, because in those days, once you've got your staff sergeant artificer, it was a fixed period of 6 years to WO2, provided you did your job okay and you got the right reports and the right recommendations. So from there, in the early March 1960, I was posted up to Anglesey, to a Royal Artillery unit in North Wales on the island of Anglesey called TEGWRA, Trials Establishment Guided Weapons Royal Artillery, where there was a huge Royal Artillery unit with a massive Remy workshops, and they were testing Thunderbird missiles, these surface-to-air missiles, which were quite revolutionary at the time. I mean, they're old museum pieces now, of course. But they were doing all the trials on they're made by British Aerospace and various other companies. So we had all the firms that had made them had detachments up there, and that was an extremely interesting couple of years. I did 3 years there. The Remy people looked after not only the missiles, but all the ground instrumentation as well. It was just like a mini Cape Canaveral. You know, they were testing the rockets with all the radar and all the safety systems. And whatever, and I loved it. It was a great 3 years there. A very good, very different to the normal radio type repairs that I'd been used to. Although there were a few radios there, but my main job there was looking after the safety system, which was called the Doppler system, a big transmitter, a big receiver, sending a signal into the missile on the ground, and then when it took off, all the boys who were watching it, they didn't shoot at real aircraft and knock them down. They had these what they call a drone aircraft that went across with all cameras on board, and the missile would take off into the Irish Sea. They'd let it go for so many miles that it had to go, do all the plotting on grass. If it was successful, fine, that was the end of it. Well, even if it wasn't successful, I mean, you know, the missile had to be then broken up. And my job was this transmitter which sent a little signal up, which opened up part of the actual dummy warhead, and the whole thing then just sort of disintegrated and fell into the North Sea. I mean, I've simplified it tremendously, but a lot of the work involved with all that was very different and very fascinating. And I was a staff sergeant then in charge of this small section of about two sergeants I had and about three or four corporals. The interesting time in 1962 was that a company of Women's Royal Army Corps, as they were called then, girls were posted in as operators. They came up from Manabir. It was a new innovation they had. There was a captain, a sergeant major lady, a sergeant, and about 30 or 40 trained girls that looked after the radar system or the plotting system. And they worked with us. And I was given four girls to come up and work on the Doppler system. They were operators. And it was so interesting to see them out there, because where we were with the transmitter, I don't know, Anglesey is quite, can be quite a wild place in the winter, beautiful in the summer, but quite wild. And we still